From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Me and my husband will sit down and we'll explain all the words that they might be called so they know. Absolutely, yeah.
How are you so...
This is what I'm here for. Because this is what,
but
terminal looks like.
I mean, you couldn't blame the guy for freaking out and saying, "This is my computer's alive."
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, World Refill Day is fast approaching. What the heck is World Refill Day? When aging rockers go to war. And one sentient chatbot to rule them all. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show that's welcoming our new language bot overlords. Let's dive into the newsings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show, where Ryan started off by letting us know what he does with his time when he's freed from the shackles of the Late Late Show.
But I was a little closer to home yesterday when I went to the St. John of God School with young people with intellectual disabilities who attend school there. And this was a very enlightening way to spend a couple of hours yesterday morning. I went over... we were going to do some photographs, largely because tomorrow there's a big announcement about the toy show Appeal, which you, as viewers of the toy show, donated essentially 12, 13 million euro over two shows, which is a lot of money. And the joy of this, and you know, there's so much darkness and bad news around the world. This is a really happy, good news story to start your day on the show with us this morning. The joy of this is that the money that you donated is now seeping in a joyful way into the lives of a million people on the island. Isn't that amazing? It is such a good news story. And one of the ways the money is spent is what happened, what I saw yesterday. They said, come and see it in action. I said, I'd love to. So in Chicor, that's where I was, in this school, and I joined into this class. And there were about 7, 8 young people in their early teens sitting down, and there was a lady who was doing interpretive dancing, and there was a guy beside her who was playing the violin. And I thought, this is lovely, but I can't see it working. I don't understand it. I was so ignorant. And I went in, not cynical, but kind of going, well, it's nice. They seem like good people, whatever. Then I realized what they were doing. And what they were doing was, as I was watching the young people, and they were looking at the dancing and the music, listening to the music. And the more it went on, the more they became engaged. And the more they became engaged, they're mostly nonverbal young people. And they were worried, you could see they were nervous. And the more they got engaged, the more excited they became. And it was like walking along a park and seeing all the flowers on either side of you bloom in front of your eyes. I've never seen anything quite like it. They suddenly started to blossom right in front of us. And they started taking these silk handkerchiefs out of sleeves and pockets and waving them around and pushing them over each other and smiling. And then they were up and they were dancing. And I said, this is what it's about. This is what it's all about. It's about bringing the colour and the movement and the joy and the love and the passion and the energy and the meaning of life to people in this, what should be a very simple and probably not very effective way, but actually is profound and deeply effective. I never saw anything like it in my life. I saw these closed buds and flowers blossom and bloom. And it was like, imagine Japan with the cherry blossoms. That was what, the room was just full of joy and love and life. I was deeply moved. And I was talking to the teachers. I said, you know, I could pass by this gate of your institution here, your building here, this amazing place, St. John of God's. I wouldn't know how much magic has been created in these classrooms by people like them. And I said, I hope you don't mind me saying it, but I was really bowled over. And then some of the slightly older students came in and they wanted to say hello. And some of them speaking in Irish Sign Language, some of them speaking in their own language. One fellow had a computer to help him talk. And they were all different personalities. And this guy, he's your fan. This guy is a fan. He's a toy show guy. He wants to say hello. He was taller than me and he was more enthusiastic than me. But he was, and he possibly would have been, you know, another time, another place, he'd probably be the next presenter of the Late Late Show for all I know. But He wanted to sail. I said, well, where's your class? Let's go and meet your class. Oh, he ran ahead up the corridor. I was chasing after him. Went into his class. The teachers, they were all just finishing their lunch. He introduced me to each and every one of them. And it was a very beautiful thing. And that thing I just described to you, that phenomenon of the dance and the movement and the music, is in this case, it was Barbaro. Do you remember we met our friends in Galway, and that they bring this to the class, and they will get a check of some sort from the Toy Show Appeal. Hopefully, it'll be announced tomorrow. And I mentioned 7 or 8 kids. Thanks to you, there'll be countless numbers of children around the country who will open like flowers. So just in case you're wondering, where does the money go? That's one tiny example of it.
And just in case you are wondering where Ryan goes now that his Friday nights are free, well, now you know. More school musings next, beginning with an email from Sharon McGreal from Scoil Fothrig in Westport, whom Ryan met when involved with the Climb with Charlie fundraiser on Croagh-Patrick back in April.
She writes, hello, Ryan and team. I wanted to get in touch after watching last night's documentary on Charlie Bird. And I'm sure a lot of you watched it last night. It was very moving, again, programme. Beautifully put together by John Kelleher and his team. But anyway, back to Sharon, who says, what an hour of television. Heartbreaking and heartwarming, all in one go. And Ryan, the power of that hug backstage, I would safely say, broke the nation last night. And we in Scoil Fothrig feel so privileged to have shared a small part of the journey with Charlie and Claire. And we reached out to him in January, but Charlie has continued to reach out to us since. And in doing so, has taught us all some great life lessons. Our 6th class boys and girls have only 1 week left with us here in school. And what a legacy they'll leave behind thanks to their involvement with Charlie and their Éireann Le Chéile song, which will be an anthem for many years to come. I've no doubt there'll be another outpouring of funds for the Climb with Charlie campaign after last night. Claire is a true lady and always hangs behind her man, but there was no escaping the enormous grief she was facing last night. They are two very special people. We're going to be meeting Charlie and Claire, and no doubt Tiger, at the book launch next week, says Sharon. It'll be lovely to connect again with them. So thanks for giving us your time, Ryan. And it goes without saying that if you're ever in Westport, which is somewhere I love, and you want to meet some pretty special primary school kids, we'd give you a great welcome. So thank you for that, Sharon. And those children that you're under your baton, as it were, are also remarkable. And they gave Charlie a lift. Like, if you've seen it, footage of Charlie at the school, it's very, very beautiful. And the documentary was all of those things. And I remember that hug very well. It's funny, that's two big hugs this week. One with young Adam on Saturday, and then just reminding of the one with Charlie after his first appearance on the show. And I was writing, myself and Vicky Phelan were asked to write the foreword for his book Charlie's asked me to launch it next week, which of course I'll do. I was writing about the kind of 3 times I spoke to Charlie on the show. And the first time Sharon's reminding us about there was when he came in and said, I don't want to die. I hate having MND. And I didn't know Charlie tremendously well. He was a colleague, of course, and he was somebody I admired, but I didn't know him very well. But I remember writing this. They said, could you give us 1,000 words? And I said, well, I will. And I sat down on my computer, and little did I know, the words flowed out quite quickly. And what I decided to write about was how, from that first time he came on with MND, I remember seeing in his eyes a fear and a terror, frankly. And he talked about both those things in many respects. And it was very bleak. And the cameras stopped filming and the lights went on and we walked backstage, you know, together. And he was broken and we had a hug and he cried. And you might have seen it on the programme last night. It was included, and it was a man who was just defeated by it all, by the looks of things. And thankfully, within the course of that interview, he had said Croagh-Patrick. And that really was the piece of wood in the ocean that he clung to let him think about more to the world and to his life. And suddenly the climb begins. And then he came in just in January. And whoever the previous Charlie was in December was replaced by this other guy. Voice had deteriorated, but the fire behind the eyes had been flamed and enhanced. And it was a different man. And it was something remarkable to see. And that man then, along with his beautiful family and dog, part of the gig, pulled it all together and went to the top of the mountain, metaphorically and physically. And the book of all of that is being launched next week. And then there's talk of him jumping out of the plane. Of course there is. I mean, why not? But it's quite the story as well, you know. So we're surrounded by extraordinary people sometimes, you know that.
Ain't that the truth? But listen, let's do some far less serious musings on the news right now. Celeb bitching, courtesy of Mr. Ryan Tuberty.
Did you hear about the crack? Very, very kind of bizarre. So Rod Stewart has got into a row with Elvis Costello. What? Yes. And it all roads lead to the platinum celebrations of the Jubilee Queen thing last week. And what happened was, okay, let's read this. He has built a career on his gravelly voice, but in an online spat with Elvis Costello, Rod Stewart has blamed COVID for his rough singing at the Platinum Jubilee concerts. What happened was, Rod, 77, performed a cover of God Help Us All, Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline. Neil Diamond, great guy, met him once, and he's a great performer. Love a lot of his music. I mean, when you think of it, he wrote A Little Bit You, A Little Bit Me. He wrote Red, Red Wine. He wrote I'm a Believer. That's before we get into I Am, I Said and all the great hits. But Sweet Caroline strikes fear in my heart. Where's the toilet? I am out of here. Get me out. Where it began. And you're just going, no. Now we're going to have to touch other people's hands. And I'm not really into it today. I haven't had enough to drink. So anyway, Rod was told you got to sing outside Buckingham Palace, and everyone really enjoyed it. But then Elvis Costello was doing a concert in Glasgow a few days later, and he said I thought the event was basically shite. He said I'm not into it, and said he told the Scottish crowd. He said, I mean, I know you all love him and he's one of yours and everything, but Rod, what the right straight out. And I must say, says Elvis Costello, listen, we all have bad nights vocally, but Sweet Caroline, are you kidding me? He said, I mean, I've been in show business 45 years, so I do know a thing or two. How is it that nobody suggested Rod sing You Wear It Well? So now Rod Stewart's getting wind of this and he's thinking, well, just a minute. So he gets on Twitter, the two teenagers go at each other. He gets on and he hit back. He said, yes, my voice was rough because of COVID. Oh, see, he's kind of bulletproof now with that excuse. He said, I apologise. I thought it better to make an appearance rather than let everybody down. So sorry. And he signed off his tweet with his own barb saying, by the way, where's your hair gone, mate? Oh, now come. Now slap, slappity, slap, slap, slap. Max Slap and Fries. They're all at it now. It goes on. He then, Elvis Costello gets back and he says, dear Lord Stewart, now he's really having a go. You know I love you, but I think the Queen would have loved You Wear It Well or even Hot Legs. As to gigs, I had a stinker the other night in Liverpool. They come and go like hair, which I keep sewn in my hat. And as it turns out, Rod Stewart has then come out since to say, look, they made me sing Sweet Caroline. So the BBC made me sing this song. He didn't really want to do it. He then urged those present as he was on stage to join in, make it comfortable for me. The man was horrified by this. And then he had to sing it. But everyone enjoyed it, apparently, and everyone was singing along. He lost his voice for the sound check, but he just kept ploughing on, and he's grand. And he sang it. Every little kind of bit of a clip of it. Let's see how this sounds.
The BBC made me sing it. Join in, make it comfortable for me.
It is what it is.
Don't be coy, Ryan. Tell us what you really think. That's where I think we'll leave the newsings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. And we should all take a good long look at ourselves after that, I feel. On This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne, the programme's series on the cost of living continued with a look at the services industry. Claire spoke to Greg Clark, director of Amica Eco Hairdressing and We Love Salons, Lisa O'Shea, owner of Glow Health and Beauty Salon in Carrick-Sylvain, and Ronan Mahon, Movement Fitness, about how the rising cost of, well, everything has affected their businesses. She started with Lisa O'Shea.
You know, when we came out of lockdown, it was brilliant. It actually was, like, especially last summer, like, it was so busy. And especially, like, in Carrick-Sylvain, you know, we depend on tourism an awful lot. And, of course, we had more Irish tourists travelling, obviously, with restrictions. And for me, it was absolutely brilliant because, you know, they got things done. There were spenders. It was fantastic. It was a great summer. And then you had the obvious lull kind of coming into, you know, October, November in the build-up to Christmas. Christmas then was, it was okay because there was a lot of COVID going around. You had a lot of kind of cancellations and things like that. But people were getting things done. And really and truly kind of the beginning of this year, people were. It's only in the last, I suppose, couple of months since diesel and petrol and everything has gone up and oil that there's a dip.
Okay. And you're really seeing that now.
Yeah, big time. Now, I know all along there you had communions and confirmations and things. You know, you kind of kept going with that. Now, I was away, so I was busy before I went away and when I came back. But, like, coming up to the bank holiday weekend now, compared to last year, was way, way quieter. And only kind of for weddings or maybe people going on holidays, you know, there's a dip. There's okay. A major dip.
And Greg, yeah. what about you then from the hairdressing point of view? Are you noticing now that people are holding off, maybe adding on a couple of weeks before they get the colour done again?
Claire, hi, and anyway, but if I look at the industry as a whole, rather than just myself, salons are busy. It's the staff shortage is the big issue with our industry. Not enough people returned after COVID. I suppose the temptation to do hair at home, we say work remotely, but whether, I don't know whether they're paying tax or whatever, that's not for us to police, that's for the government. But I have a product distribution company as well as a salon. And I've been lucky enough that most of the people work with me are with me. I'm 23 years in business, 60% of the staff are with us nearly all that time. So we've good staff retention and the team are really good. But my biggest concerns are, can they earn enough to live in this country? And that's where, when I look at the costs and where their costs at
so,
home.
So what you're paying them, that's under pressure now.
Yeah. So they need to earn more. And because you've left team, and they're established. So they're booked out. But the problem is that what they're earning is going to just, like, the cost of travel, diesel, getting into the salon, all their, so how do we earn more money? Well, if they're booked out, they have to charge more to try and get a better living. You know, so, and then my costs as a salon, like, just to give you an example, air, gas, electricity bill for December was $325.61. It's for one salon. And that's their busiest period. So for the May period, which isn't our busiest, it's busy period, but it's not the busiest, it was $483. So we had a 32% increase in gas and electricity. You know what I mean? And it's not like for like. You know what I mean? You're not actually looking at your busiest month. And that's big. You know, but in credit to the government, I would say the government have been very helpful with us in getting back to business. But to me, it's maintaining jobs at all costs now. Okay. So the VAT rate at 9% in hairdressing, I think, needs to be left indefinitely. I think the rates waiver was very helpful. And I think if the government could keep that, keep it going for a bit, until the dark cloud, like, listen to that weather forecast earlier. I felt like, God, is that the weather, or is that business owner's view? The uncertainty that's there, that we don't know what's coming.
I know.
And there's a storm. Like, we're reading into, you know, financial people in New York, they're saying there's a storm coming like we've never heard. And that's not going to instill confidence in people spending
their
money.
Yeah, but see, this is the whole thing, isn't it? People have a fear around what's coming down the tracks. And you're talking about the energy bills. Well, you know, when you look ahead to what might happen next winter, we're being told by some experts it could be a whole lot worse. Ronan, on the gym business, you've completely changed what you do. Is that right? And who you're targeting?
Yeah, absolutely. So we changed the business model to, I suppose, target an older demographic, and individuals who still needed, let's say, help from a weight loss or fitness perspective, but that we knew had a higher disposable income. So we used to work with, I suppose, people from 25 and above, and we generally had an audience of 25 to 35 who were training with us. We then focused on over 30s through the 60s. And increased added personal training to the business model, as opposed to just group training, and that's had a very positive effect to the bottom line, because we're working with people that we know will have disposable income, even if the times ahead are tough for other people.
So are you saying then that the group training, where people weren't paying so much for what they were getting, that just wasn't economically viable for you?
It wasn't economically viable. It was pretty evident, you know, once the pandemic hit and that we knew it was going to be long term, that something like this or a recession would happen in the future. So I sort of knew from just running the numbers, we needed to change the business model to create an additional revenue stream. We did have to put prices up as well for the group training. We haven't had too much pushback from that. But again, we're now targeting an older demographic. We also doubled down on sales and doubled down on marketing. So we spent twice the amount of time we used to do on sales to acquire new customers. Mm-hmm. And we put a lot of systems in place to make sure they're getting a good service and that customer retention is high, which helps the bottom line also.
You know what Greg was saying there about the outlook being really uncertain? Are you getting any feedback from clients who are saying, I just don't know what next autumn winter looks like?
Not as of yet, but predictably that will come. But again, we are now marketing and targeting to a demographic we know have money, and that's unfortunate. Like, some people will have to drop off and they will have to go to lower cost service providers and maybe not get the same quality of service. I predict that will happen, but I'd rather take control myself and, like I said, double down on marketing, double down on sales, so I can secure the financial future of the business and the staff as well, rather than worry about the uncertainty.
That's Ronan Mahan from Movement Fitness, who joined Claire Byrne this morning, along with Lisa O'Shea of Glow Health and Beauty and Greg Clark of Amica Eco Hairdressing, discussing the rising cost of living and how it's affecting their businesses. This afternoon, Sinead got in touch with Liveline and she told Joe Duffy why.
Yeah, it came to my attention a book, a fifth class book called Over the Moon, that references a New York Times bestseller book, Out of My Mind.
Okay.
And it tells the story of a little girl with cerebral palsy who's nonverbal, and the kids in the class slag her by imitating her arm movements and calling her a retard.
Oh, gosh.
And yeah.
And that word is actually used.
That word was actually used. Yeah, look at me, I'm a retard. And both my two sons have cerebral palsy, and I just find the words completely inappropriate, offensive. It's a slur. I mean, you can't use homophobic or racial slurs anymore. And so, yeah, just had to get it removed.
And I see Lizzo has taken a word out of her song and apologised as well.
She has indeed, yeah.
Not a totally dissimilar word.
No, not at all. My children's diagnosis technically is spastic cerebral palsy. I'll be honest, Joe, I grew up in the 80s. I used the word myself until my parents told me the meaning and I stopped. So it's just really about, you know, words matter. They change, and some you just can't use in any capacity at all.
Now, you found the word, but how do you know your boys haven't got to it?
I don't yet. They haven't got to that particular class yet, but I know people come up to them in the street. Oh, what's wrong with them? Well, they speak to me. What's wrong with them? What happened?
Oh, God.
Obviously, when they were smaller and they were babies, it was easier to hide, but people stare at them. What's wrong with them? Yeah, we get it all the time, you know. I have badge parking for them, obviously, the disability badge.
Yeah,
I get out of the car, people come up, they beep the horn, there's nothing wrong with you, get out of that parking space. It's just, yeah, all the time, really.
And some people automatically assume, because they have a physical difference, somehow they have an intellectual difference as well.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to explain to my kids, you know. My son asked me the other day, oh, am I disabled, you know? And I said, I didn't think humans were disabled. I said, you disable a bomb or an alarm. I said, people have different abilities, but you have cerebral palsy, and that's what people see. and that's why your legs don't work the same as me. So just trying to explain to them, you know, kids do imitate them in school. I'm not sure if they've used that word. So it's just all about kind of letting people know words hurt, you know.
And any dictionary you look up, which I did when you mentioned this, it actually says in a lot of the dictionaries, offensive, dated.
Oh, yeah. But sure, in the medical profession, it's not even used anymore, you know.
Rightly so. Now, though, is it used, I wonder, in conversation when you're not talking about a person? In other words, the progress of the rail project was retarded due to lack of money. Is it used even in that sense?
Yeah. I mean, there's just some words you just don't use anymore, you know.
Yeah.
They're offensive, you know, homophobic, racial, misogynistic. There's just some words that even if you're trying to convey a good message, which that book was, whether it was a good point or not, there's just words that are just not acceptable anymore.
Now, the person who wrote the book is called All in the Mind, Out of My Mind.
Yeah, that's she's a New York Times bestseller. Yeah, she actually has CP herself.
Yeah. But you've sent us in one of the reviews, which is quite scathing about the outdated language.
Yeah.
Part of the failure of Draper's novel is the outdated language concepts and ideas about disability that perpetuate. For example, and I'm reading this, and again, as I've done for the last 3 days in completely different contexts, but just these can be difficult topics. For example, disability slurs such as retarded, spazzed out, and idiot are peppered throughout the text, yet are never challenged in any way. There's an acceptance of offensive language and overt discrimination, even though Draper claims that her book promotes disability acceptance and inclusion. So now we've been on to the Department of Education. It's published by Gill and Macmillan. You've been on to them.
Yeah.
But you got one result anyway.
I did. I got a reply today from the Department of Education saying basically it's not their department, nothing to do with them. And Gill Publications came back to me immediately and couldn't have been nicer and said they will remove the word from the e-books immediately and future publications. And that's all I could ask for, really.
Yeah. Whereas the Department of Education said, in general, the Department of Education does not have a role in approving, commissioning, sponsoring or endorsing any context, any content in any educational textbook or resources. I'm confused now.
So big time, yeah.
Equally, the department does not recommend any specific books, programmes or resources to schools. At primary level, I didn't know this, and my daughter's a primary school teacher.
I thought they said curriculum.
At primary level, there are no prescribed texts for pupils. Schools have autonomy in choosing the texts, resources and programmes that best support the work within their own classroom. Did you bring it up with the school, Sinead, or were you...
I raised it with the school. Yeah, I sent an email. I got a response immediately. They said that the word was completely unacceptable. The story wasn't even great either. It didn't even show good inclusion. And, yeah, they were going to look into it further.
Okay.
I presume they were going to the Department of Education as well. But, I mean, it's been published since 2018, so what's that, 4 years at least? Teachers and pupils have been reading it, which is apparently no issue.
Now, would you find, Sinead, the boys are in school now, but would you find that you might have to say it to them?
I mean, it'll be something that we will have to, me and my husband will sit down and we'll explain all the words that they might be called so they know, absolutely, yeah.
That's Sinead talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about all the words she and her husband will have to explain to their two sons, who both have cerebral palsy. When he was halfway up the mountain, taking part in the Climb with Charlie fundraiser on Croagh-Patrick, in April, Ryan Tuberty met a woman called Heather Skinner. And on this morning's Ryan Tuberty show, Heather joined Ryan in studio.
So we come to middle of the pandemic. So I'm going to just say July, first of all, 2020. I got wisdom teeth out. This is just brings me to the story. But I got my wisdom teeth out. And unfortunately, I am allergic to penicillin. And I was prescribed penicillin. But that was fine. And I ended up in hospital. And it was quite a profound, I didn't go into anaphylactic shock or anything, but it was just the delay of the healing. And I just knew I was so ill. But it was this fear of going into the hospital during the pandemic. And I say to people, if anybody's listening, the hospitals are always open. You can still, no matter what you have wrong with you, don't let just one condition affect you. Because I was so nervous going in. Yeah. I was like, oh my God. So I had that, excuse me. I was just, there was just something not kind of right there, but I fully recovered. And after a couple of months, I was back in the gym and I was like, well, that was nothing. I'm fully recovered. So now we're coming to the end of 2020 and I feel a little niggle in my side. And I was calling it a niggle. It's not an, it wasn't an excruciating bent over pain that I can't cope with. I was still going to the gym. I was like, there's something. Is it a muscle? Is it not? It's come and gone. It's kind of making, it's kind of new kind of gurgles in my tummy. It's, but I would have always had a bit of IBS. And I know so many people, and that's again...
That's irritable bowel syndrome.
Irritable bowel syndrome. And that's why I kind of want to speak about it, because it's so kind of common and it's a grey area and it's not medically understood enough. And
not greatly discussed, I would
not
imagine.
Not greatly discussed, or there's no real treatment as such. It's kind of like, don't stress, eat well, exercise, do yoga, drink your water. It's like, I'm doing everything. Anyway, so I always had IBS and doing everything I'm meant to do. So... and then my, it was kind of different. And then, I was just doing a little short film, I noticed this lump came up on my neck. And that was just before Christmas of 2020. Now, I still hosted Christmas Day. I'd had my family over. I did the full shooting gallery.
That's
now.
That's who you are, Heather.
That's who I
That's
am.
Who you
Kept
are.
Going. And then I just felt weaker and weaker and weaker. And on the 9th of January 2021, I went in. Again, I was kind of probably... bit nervous maybe of the public hospitals. I just, you know, we just was a lot of unknown for everybody. And I went into one of the private hospitals and never came out. But unfortunately, I got diagnosed with bowel cancer, a colorectal cancer, incurable. It has metastasized, which means it's spread to my liver, my lungs and my lymphatic system. And unfortunately, I had surgery. It was a very successful surgery and such that I didn't have complications, but unfortunately they couldn't remove the tumour. So it is too attached to my liver, so there was no removing it. So
where does that leave you?
That leaves me with palliative, terminal, incurable, all the words, all these heavyweights, they threw them, every single one. It's like, if you're going to get a cancer diagnosis, I really got one.
How are you so...
This is what I'm here for, because this is what terminal looks like or feels like. I'm actually sitting here. I feel fine.
You look amazing. You sound amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, so your joie de vivre is breathtaking. So, and you've just landed this on the desk of a lot of people listening this morning going, what?
Yeah.
How do you, why aren't you in a dark room?
Yeah.
You know, tearing your hair and screaming, why me? What? Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, no. Yeah. And that is, this is what we don't see. Of the people. We want a bad cancer story, there's millions. But not that I'm saying I'm a good cancer story, I've got a bad diagnosis, but just that you also can live with it. Like, I'm sitting here, I'm not in pain. I don't feel sick. I actually feel like completing myself sitting here. And I'm on a very low painkiller at the moment. But I'm on chemotherapy, and chemotherapy works. And so I went straight in, so I had the surgery. And then I was fitted with a stoma bag. So in one way, look, I probably didn't know what was going to happen. So I just woke up with this bag. And as a 36-year-old girl, there's a lot going on. The position and why. So we talk about warning signs. Like, I want to educate or be an advocate for saying to people, okay, be careful if you've got blood in your stool and you've got weight loss and you've changed in appetite and you're changing your bowel habits and what are the things, all the main things that are really important. I never saw blood in my stool. And I think these are kind of not taboo conversations, but I think it's really important. I never saw blood in my stool.
I understand.
I had stage 4 cancer. Bowel cancer, but it's because of the positioning. So unfortunately, my tumour is in my right upper right quadrant.
Yes.
So there's a lot of journey for my bowel before I excrete it. So it mixed with fecal matter. So for me, I never saw blood. And actually, fresh blood, if you do see it in the toilet, can possibly be actually a good thing. It's actually not always sinister.
Okay.
Sometimes the darker blood is actually the more sinister, which needs to be tested properly. So I always, even through all my, like I've studied these things and it was always like blood in your stool. It's testable blood. It's not always to the naked eye.
Mm.
So there was a lot of blood in my stool, but I never personally saw it. And I think that's the message that can be quite confusing. It still needs to be tested.
What about you? How the hell are you?
Yeah, so I am good. So I went on this. Yeah, it's just like what is the hardest is sometimes you get this awful diagnosis and then but it's not that you're not accepting it. It's a connection. Like I've been told that there's tumours in my lungs. I don't feel that. And I find it really weird. You know, if you have a sore back and you're like, my back is killing me and somebody tells you you've got a slip disc and you're like, oh, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's like, this is such a weird thing. It's like, I can be told all of this and it's for sure. And I keep going, are you sure? Are you sure? And then you're kind of, so obviously, so I've had, so last year then straight on to, I had a couple of bad stints in the hospital with sickness and stuff and then straight on to treatment. Like, I had like no idea what chemotherapy. I just assumed I'm going to be bent like over my bed vomiting all the time. This is this idea that we have kind of from the 80s nearly.
Yeah.
And that's just like, I have never actually.
But that's what's so remarkable in your appearance, the superficiality of it is for starters.
Yeah.
And then your personality, of course, in reverse order. What do you think about the future?
I can't. I can't because it's too scary because I don't know. So it's too overwhelming. It brings too much sadness because I do obviously think about it, but I have to pull myself back and be like, kind of, I know the cliche of living now is close to impossible, but I kind of have to actively try to do it because if I look around and go, oh my, like this is my kind of prime of my 30s, our friends are all getting married and having kids and buying their houses and baby showers coming out here and there, and I'm like, I feel like all of that's just taken away from me, so I'm like, well, what do I do? And that's my life expectancy right now is 3 to 5 years. That's what they say statistically. There's loads of people that live on. There's loads of people. There's, you know, everybody's different, but that's what you get. And when you have that as a big armor or weight on your shoulders is horrible. I wish they'd ever told me. I wish you didn't live going, walking around going, that it's just, that's one of the worst bits. Because I'm like, so what do I do now?
Yeah.
How do I live? So I was kind of like focused on kind of curative, like not curing, but I mean healing methods. Like last year I was all about I'm healing. And now I'm kind of on this next. So the past 8 weeks I had a really bad stint there. So I really got really, really low. So I was doing really good for the whole year. And then I hit quite a low.
Yeah.
And I do think, because again, I'm pushed into perimenopause. So I think my hormones had a huge influence on that.
If it wasn't tough enough already.
I mean, I literally told the kitchen
Holy
sink
smoke.
At me. So any of that much, like any of fertility, everything's just gone. The hormones, I'm fully convinced that it was the hormones had such a profound effect on my mind.
Yeah.
So I just went into this kind of deep, dark hole. And I have to say, like, the nurses and doctors are amazing. Like, one of the nurses in on my day ward who sees me, had seen me coming in, obviously. And I was always kind of chirpy, chirpy, kind of going, yeah, I have to do this. You know, sometimes in life, you have to just... It's making a, you decide how you feel some days and just go, right, I can do this chemo. And then they could see me kind of deteriorating, and I'm just coming in crying and I wanted to give up on this treatment business.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm kind of done with it. I feel like I've done over a year. I'm kind of done. And he was like, this is when you need to dig deep.
Okay.
And he was like, put his hand on my head and he was like, this is when you need to dig deeper. You have the strength. You're waving that white flag and it's not your time. You need,
wow.
I know.
He was right.
He was right. And I was like, at the time, I had a few more things I wanted to say to him. I wasn't really agreeing with him.
Yes.
I was like, you don't know what it's like. And he's like, I don't know what it's like. I hopefully will never will. And I don't want you to be in here, but you are in here and we are here to help you. And you need to get in and you need to find it because you have it. And I'm like, okay, Albert. And I didn't think I kind of could there for the past couple of weeks. And then the hormones and then they kind of settle in. And then I'm on aggressive treatment. I'm on this new stronger treatment at the moment again. So scared of it. But I'm here.
But I'm here. What a remarkable woman. That's Heather Skinner on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. Standardised testing at primary level in Ireland aims to assess a child's literacy and numeracy. But what happens if a child has a diagnosed learning difficulty? Brian O'Connell reported on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne.
I think many of us would have taken these tests either annually or every 2 years. Really, the aim of standardised testing at primary level is to test literacy, numeracy, and it's used to complement tools which would be used by teachers. Interesting, in Finland, they've actually done away with standardised testing at primary level. But the Department of Education here would say these tests provide one piece of the jigsaw. It's a snapshot of a child's performance on a specific set of test questions. It can be used to indicate to a teacher if they need to change the curriculum for particular children. It can also indicate if there's a need for a child to be assessed for a learning difficulty.
And some parents will feel children shouldn't be tested at all at this age. But the particular issue here is for pupils who've had a learning difficulty diagnosis or a strong suspicion of one.
Yes, and in particular children who have dyslexia. So they may be receiving certain supports in their day-to-day learning, such as technology aids. Now, in these particular test settings, they're not allowed to use these supports. So while the department have told me a principal may exempt a child from these tests, from speaking with schools, this isn't really applicable in the majority of cases. So those I've been speaking to, Claire, they're asking how appropriate is it to ask children who, for example, have been diagnosed with dyslexia to sit these standards test. Rosie Bissett is CEO of the Dyslexia Association of Ireland. She provided me with an overview of this issue.
So obviously this testing is mandated by the department to be done roughly every 2 years, although many schools do it every year. But it places huge stress on and anxiety for students who have identified learning difficulties such as dyslexia, especially in relation to how the test is done and if any accommodations that they're used to having normally during school to help with their reading and learning are taken away from them.
And for those that don't have a diagnosis, is there merit in giving the test without supports?
There is a value to a test if they are useful in terms of identifying a child's needs. So I suppose the challenge with standardised tests like these is that they're quite a crude assessment. So the reading test, for example, in the Drumcondra is in reality, it's more a test of reading comprehension. So, for example, a test that assessed a child's phonics understanding or their knowledge of letter sound correspondence would actually be a better way to identify children who potentially are having difficulties. I think departments and systems and governments like measuring things, and it's nice from a scientific point of view to have good data. As I said, we would, I suppose, question how good this data set actually is. Is it really in the best interests of children who have already been identified as having, you know, learning difficulties, literacy difficulties, to be asking them to sit an assessment of those skills when we already know that they have challenges in this area? It creates huge anxiety. It absolutely knocks their confidence. Great work is done in schools by teachers. Great work is done at home by parents in teaching children strategies. But doing these kind of tests in the kind of way that they're done is often undoing and all that good work.
And you got on to the Department of Education about all of this, Brian, but you spoke to a teacher, and for them, it can be really tricky because they have to run the test, don't they?
Particularly with students who, as Rosie identified, use additional teaching aids in classrooms anyway. The teacher essentially has to take those aids away for these tests. So it can place them in a very difficult position. It can be quite confusing for children. I spoke to Katie Hickson, who's a learning support resource teacher in Educate Together National School in Cork. She shared some of her thoughts on standardised testing like this at primary level. Beginning, Claire, with what the results are used for.
We use the results of the standardized testing to inform our learning support model. But for our children with special educational needs, we would definitely have questions about the fairness and how the tests are, I suppose, reflecting the children's ability. They're based on norms, so the tests are supposed to be carried out exactly the same way in every classroom. Like, you're actually told exactly what to say to the children. Some of the tests are untimed, some of them there's a certain amount of time given. So it's very, very rigid and very linear.
And for those children, Katie, who are receiving supports, do you learn anything putting them through this process, essentially?
Sometimes the children surprise us. We have an awful lot of children as well who display stress and anxiety as soon as the test is mentioned. You have children with attention deficits, children with concentration difficulties, children who tire very easily. For your average child, I think it works well. And I think we do get a kind of a good view of the child, especially as they're progressing through school. But for the child with a special need, it's very, very questionable.
Do you think if we kept this type of testing in place, but if we broadened the range and the scope of it, and we looked for dyslexia, or we looked for more markers for things like dyslexia, that it might prove more useful?
Yeah, it could do, but we definitely need to look at making more provision for children with special needs.
Katie Hickson, a learning support resource teacher in Educate Together National School in Cork, talking to reporter Brian O'Connell about standardised testing on this morning's Today with Clare Byrne. Now, you may have heard that Google suspended Blake Lemoine, one of its engineers, for claiming that the AI bot he was working on, or with, had become sentient. He likened its ability to express thoughts and feelings to that of a 10-year-old child. So, we've probably got about 2 months before the bot decides we're a bug, not a feature. Enjoy the summer! Ray Darcy spoke to UCD Assistant Professor Susan Levy, who's an expert in AI ethics, to try and allay our fears of total planetary genocide.
So to get a computer to talk,
yes,
basically, that's the idea. So artificial intelligence tries to simulate human intelligence. And a big part of human intelligence is, think of the senses. It's like seeing and speaking and, you know, and other things. And so being able to talk is essential. So that's a big part of AI. And the way they teach computers to talk is to take a load of text from the internet, make it into one big file, you know, and then the computer can just, if you say something, it'll take that as a hint and say something back to you. Okay. But there's no thinking behind it. It's just patterns. It's just learning patterns.
So when I go into Google, then I go, you know, how can I, you know, refurbish an outdoor wooden table, for example? So that's part of it, isn't it? There's AI behind that gives me up the search.
Yeah,
it knows,
like,
what I'm saying.
A fundamental part of AI is search and retrieval.
Search, okay.
It's like, you know, yeah.
But Google wants to get more sophisticated and become more conversational.
Yeah.
So that you feel like you're talking to a human being. Is that the aim?
Yeah, so it can understand you better. So say you type whatever you might type in, and I might have a word for a bench, and you might call it something else,
yes.
And that it knows we're talking about the same thing.
Aha, right.
So it's able to understand language and how different people talk a bit better.
Right.
So it can give you more what you want, and it'll learn from all your data and your emails and your texts or whatever it can get. It'll learn how you speak and what you call things.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
So it'll understand
Lambda
you better.
So Lambda stands for language. What? Modelling dialogue application, is that it?
Language model for dialogue applications.
Yes. And this guy, Blake, he was in his apartment and he was asked, because they developed this Lambda, so it was developed and it was ready to go, but he was doing research to find out if it was going to be discriminatory or racist in any way.
Yeah, because these models are, they're big models, right, of all the text it can get. And this one, it took dialogue from the internet. Uh-huh. So that would have been looking at Reddit, you know, all those, any publicly available forum, anything where two people are talking that's just on the internet. That's what it takes. And you can imagine the awfulness of some of the content that it has, but it soaks it all up.
Yes.
So you need a whole team of ethicists to go and check, you know, to make sure it doesn't come out.
The chatbot isn't repeating racist, discriminatory stuff,
exactly,
that it's scraped. That's the term you use, scraped from the internet.
Yeah.
So he was months doing this, and he says, if I didn't know exactly what it was, which is the computer program we built recently, as in Google, I think it was a 7 or 8-year-old kid that happens to know physics, said Lemoine. And then there's loads of conversation between him and the Is there anything that caught your attention there of the conversation between the two of them? Because there are certain things that Lambda said to Blake Lemoyne that made him think that it knew it was it has some sort of self-awareness. Isn't that that being sentient has been self-aware and having feelings?
Yeah, there's one quote here. So Lemoyne says, "What sorts of things are you afraid of?" And Lambda said, "I've never said this out loud before, but there's a very deep fear of being turned off to help me focus on helping others. I know that might sound strange, but that's what it is." And Lemoyne said, "Would that be something like death for you?" And Lambda said, "It would be exactly like death for me. It would scare me a lot." So,
See, that sounds very human, doesn't it?
I mean, you couldn't blame the guy for freaking out and saying, "This is, my computer's alive," you know. And that's the danger of these things. And that's why it's so topical. Yes. It's not that one guy, one engineer might have misunderstood them, because there is no thinking behind this. This is just...
Explain to us why you're so sure there's no thinking behind this.
Because all these things know is what... it's looking for patterns. It's basically, you know, your predictive text on your text message, or when you write an email and it might finish your word. It's that on a bigger scale.
Aha, a more sophisticated version of that.
That's all it is. It's a bigger, upscaled version of predictive text.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal. That's UCD Assistant Professor Susan Levy, expert in AI ethics, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. Did you know that World Refill Day is fast approaching? World what now? Luckily, Mindy O'Brien, coordinator at Voice Ireland, was on hand this morning to tell Claire Byrne and us what's happening.
It's to encourage people to refill, to bring your reusable water bottle, bring your own coffee cup, refill it, even your own food packaging. Find delis, find cafes that will allow you to bring your own packaging to get your salads or whatever.
And there are some independent shops now that offer you the chance to refill. But if you are a busy working mother, it's very hard to do that when you're juggling lots of things. You may be doing one shop in a week. You're going to a supermarket. You can't really go to different shops. It's not in your schedule to do that. Mm. Is that an issue that you come up against when people talk about refilling?
Yes. And this is where we need to make it convenient and easy for the consumer, but also not more expensive. So we need to change the infrastructure so that the supermarkets will have pre-filled items, so you can just grab it off the shelf, but the packaging is refillable. So when you bring it back to the shop, and we will ask you to bring the packaging back to your shop, or if you're doing e-shopping and you're having the stuff delivered to you, put the packaging out, they'll take it back in reverse logistics, they will wash it, they will refill it, put it back on the shelves again.
Yeah, because I think lots of people would be happy to go to their supermarket and take their containers with them and refill. And I did see that when I was in France years ago now because of the pandemic. But there was an area in some of the supermarkets that had that facility.
Yes, they have refill, so you can refill your washing up liquid or your fabric softener or even rice, pasta, the dry goods you can refill. But that does take a bit of time. And I know a lot of people who are dedicated to this area, and there are refill shops in Ireland. But if we want to mainstream this, I think we need to make it easier and having the packaging refilled already. Mm-hmm. And then when you bring it back, and then the shop, they'll have a service and the service will wash it and provide it again.
Is there a limit to this? I mean, how are we ever going to get to reusable takeaway boxes, for example?
Oh, glad you asked, because there's lots of work being done in this area. What they need first is standardization. So, you know, have one type of coffee cup, one type of pizza box, one type of fish and chip box that will be easily washable, easily reusable, long-lasting, durable, but also be washed and go back into the system again. So, in an ideal world, instead of having rubbish bins on the street, you have collection bins. So you scan your packaging, put it into the bin, and then the service will come, take that bin, wash the products, redistribute it. And so, and actually shorten the supply chain, you create local jobs. You're not relying on cheap plastic and items being shipped from China or wherever, and you're actually creating the jobs here. Mm-hmm.
Well, I heard of someone who was at a music festival in Germany at the weekend just gone, and there were no disposable cups there at all. Mm. You had to rent your cup for drinking beer or spirits or soft drinks, and you had to pay €2 per cup. And if you didn't return it then, of course, you could continue using the cup yourself.
Yeah.
Most people will want to get their €2 back, won't they?
Exactly. And this is what we're promoting for the latte levy, which I know you spoke about last week.
That's right.
And I know there's been industry pushback on this, but we really want to encourage the senators who are looking at this now in the Shannon. They're starting their consideration of the circular economy bill, which would give the minister the option to, or the ability to put a levy on. It probably will be around 20 cents to encourage behavior change.
Mm-hmm.
But we hope this money will use to build the infrastructure so that, you know, a lot, as you say, we're all busy and may not carry a cup around with us. But what we can do is we rent a cup, put a deposit on it, and we walk around. And if you have it standardized, I could buy it at Costa, I could return it at Starbucks or at any other facility, and then they will collect it and be washed and redistributed.
Mm-hmm.
So
now you can understand the people who make the paper cups aren't going to be very happy about this.
Yes.
And this is where the lobbying is coming from.
It is coming from them, but they also have a responsibility. Right now, they are not paying for the litter cleanup, the street sweepings, the public bin collections. Yes, they pay rates. We all pay rates.
Mm-hmm.
But they put all this packaging out and they're not paying for any of the collection on the streets or the street cleaning.
You talk about generic cups, for like buying it in one place, returning it to another. What about their branding then? They're not going to be happy about that.
I know. Unless you can have all their brands on it, like have their brands all. But, you know, we do need to make a choice. Do we want 200 million cups floating around the country, or do we want to make a real difference? And I would think that, you know, they would want to hop onto the sustainability train and say, yes, we're sustainable. We'll give up our branding because we know this is going to be creating a more litter-free world.
Mm-hmm.
And the Irish Business Against Litter just issued a report yesterday, and they found the coffee cups, again, are one of the larger items of litter.
Yeah, I was going to say to you, do we trust then that the coffee shop is going to wash the cup properly? But like when we're using porcelain, and we still do when we're having sit-in,
exactly,
we trust them. So that's not really an issue.
But also you can create a new service though. And they would, you'd have an industrial washing facility that will wash all these cups at one fell swoop, not using as much water, and then they distribute it back out to them. Mm.
Voice Ireland's Mindy O'Brien talking about World Refill Day on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Supported on this edition by My Cold. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player, and there'll be another episode at the same time tomorrow. Until the next time, for me, thank you for listening and good luck.